This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Willkommen. Welcome to the show. It is episode 242, and you know what that music means. It is part two, Art After Money, Money After Art. Author Max Haven has returned. This is where we really dig into Max's book in earnest. I do read lots of passages. I'll tell you about that in a moment. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can find an eclectic set of images that I've curated based on our conversation from Max's book and beyond. And as far as the several read passages, I do read several times, as you may have seen on Instagram if you follow me there, at Artist Podcast. I posted the hell out of this book. And so it's been hard to narrow down the sections that we're able to fit into this conversation and future conversations. In any case, all that said, I do read several passages, and my thinking, and I ran this by Max, was there is no more concise way to get to some of this material than simply reading from the book. I ended up reading because I wanted Max to do the sort of responses to the passages upon my prompting, and you know, he was fine with that. That was actually kind of his suggestion. And producer Andy Davis vetted what you're going to hear and said, if the passages that I'm reading are too dense, you can always rewind and re-listen. So there is that. Thank you very much to Andy for doing so. And thanks to Max's very generous continued participation in this mini-series, you are getting mind-blowing content, as I said last time, or with the last Max episode. So I have two quick favors to ask you. One is, please tell a friend or colleague about this podcast, this series with Max in particular, and when you recommend episodes to new listeners to this show, do have them start with this series, starting with part one. The second favor is, if you have never financially supported this show, or you haven't in a couple or more years, please do so now. If you're an artist who makes a living from your work, please do donate to the podcast. And thank you very much to all of you who do. I appreciate it very much in advance. One of the many paradigm-shifting topics that Max introduces in his book, and which we talk about here, is the concept of the radical imagination, which, as you will find, is a very challenging way to think about our own respective art making, if, as is the case with me and a very large percentage of you listening, were engaged in making or maker's art, which is to say objects of all sorts. So thinking about the radical imagination, and essentially that the short version of that is thinking way outside the box. Even if you continue to be a painter, a drawer, a sculptor, a maker of some sort, using your radical imagination, as you will in some ways hear in our conversation, is a way to raise your game, to challenge your work. And ultimately, this is a good thing. And I know it's going to seem like growing pains. It's going to seem like a total paradigm shift for you. But indeed, long term, it is for the best, I believe. Among the various things that we talk about, and particularly things that I particularly was enthusiastic to talk about, and I hope that you are excited to hear about, are Hans Hacke's amazing institutional critique, the one in particular that was at MoMA. And another is simply the body of work, if you will, of the late, great Lee Lozano, who, of course, you may be aware of, has been getting a lot of attention lately. We delve in particular into her money piece, appropriately enough. And in talking about her and the tragedy, ultimately, that was her career, it's still, there's something ironically beautiful, even to the point of seeing a band, you know, your favorite band doing you know, a particular song that gives you goosebumps. There's something about talking about her legacy that I think might inspire groups. Maybe I'm overselling this, but you have that to look forward to among many other. There was also an extended conversation about Abbie Hoffman and the Yippies, seminal intervention at the New York Stock Exchange and pieces that subsequently followed that, and so much more. And on the back end of the episode, it's just going to be a quick triptych of old news, a.k.a. Weisslinks, your after-dinner mints following a great meal. And finally, please keep in mind that Max and I will be recording part three of our series soon. So if you do have questions, and please do step up and have questions in addition to donating, be sure to send them along in whatever form you feel comfortable. So without any further ado, here is part two with Max Haven. I'll talk to you on the back end. Okay, so we're finally diving into the book now, and not that we covered all of chapter one, but we're going to start with chapter two, which you title Six Artists Times Two Crises Times Three Orders of Reproduction. And the gist of it, in short, is you look at three artists circa 1973 and three artists more recently around the 2008 financial crisis. And so I'm just going to start reading here from page 64 of your book. The interconnected global financial apparatus is one that is dominated by digitized forms of money or money-like objects that circulate on a vastly greater magnitude than cash or even pedestrian bank deposits. Only a small fraction of existing money in the global economy is actually represented by cash. For this reason, artworks that engage with the cash as a physical or a symbolic entity engage in a kind of critical anachronism. This chapter then engages a range of artists engaged with money in its less material or tangible forms as a means to explore the processes of financialization and the possibilities and perils of challenging it. To do so, we will explore the work of three artists in each of two critical periods. First, I explore the work of three artists created in and around the year of 1973, which, for reasons that will become clear, I and others mark as the dawn of our current financialized phase of capitalism. I then compare these to three parallel works created in the shadow of the 2008 financial crisis some 35 years later. In each case, I am interested in the fate of the radical artist. By radical here, I mean to introduce a third term beyond the relationship of the critical and the contemporary problematized in the last chapter. My definition of radical here draws on my and Alex Kasnabish's theorization of the term in our work on the radical imagination. Briefly, radical means not only approaches that are politically extreme by the conventions of the day, though they may indeed be that, but that are also dedicated to exploring and unsettling the roots of social, economic, and political institutions. This notion of radicalism, and specifically the radical imagination, draws on the work of Cornelius Castoriadis, you can correct my pronunciation, who posited this typically euphemized force as, in fact, the ontological substance of society itself. The radical imagination is that magma-like force that solidifies into social institutions forms of authority and durable forms of power. But it is also that tectonic power that periodically erupts and melts down these seemingly eternal forms of power and authority. In this chapter, I want to signal my interest in a deep radicalism that animates the work of activist artists who are not satisfied with the transmutation of criticality into contemporaneity for the pleasure of the art market, but instead aim towards some deeper social transformation based on a confrontation with power. Whether and how their aim is true or errant is another important question. So before we move on to Joseph Beuys, the first of the three artists that you write about, can you explain a little bit this contrast of the radical imagination, radical art, and this transmutation of criticality into contemporaneity for the pleasure of the art market?
Sure. Well, I think one thing that we spoke about in our last conversation and that many people will have observed about contemporary art worlds and contemporary art markets is they're suffused with critical discourse. you know, the kind of whole cloth incorporation of the of sort of a French intellectual tradition, especially Foucault, Derrida, others, into the way that we talk about art indicates something very curious, especially because most of the those philosophers and theorists were themselves pretty ardent anti-capitalists. And it's strange that their work and their discourse has been sort of folded into an art market that is rapaciously capitalistic. And, you know, many of the people who are using this rhetoric or these terminologies, in fact, would probably strongly disagree with the authors of them. So the strange way that I identified earlier in the book that the critical impulse, the impulse to make a criticism of society, has actually been folded into art today, art that's being produced today. And it's in fact what gives art its sense of being this word that we have, contemporary, of the moment, in the moment. And on one hand, I am a critical theorist who is engaged with contemporary art, so I don't want to say that that means that all critical discourse is therefore bankrupt. But I do think we need to have a note of skepticism around it, because though this rhetoric may speak, you know, use words like revolutionary or radical or, you know, challenging power, often it's in fact being used to reinforce systems and structures of power. So for this reason, I sort of reach for, and I should say that, you know, the in that first chapter, I argue, and later on in the book too, that that contemporaneity, that being in the moment that draws on critical discourse and critical rhetoric, that's precisely what gives contemporary art its market value, you know, beyond the appearance of the artwork itself. So I'm very suspicious of that. And so I want to introduce this third term of radical, which is something that, I, as in the passage you just read, I draw from the study of social movements that I did with my colleague Alex Kasnavich. Which means something much more deeper than just a kind of critical rhetorical analysis. It actually means active experimentations with living and practicing life together differently.
Is Alex actually at your university, or is he just a colleague in the field?
Yeah, he works at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax, and I worked in Halifax for many years as well, so that's where we worked together.
One thing that I'm curious about, as you talked about the French, mainly French theoreticians, philosophers, who were essentially assimilated, correct me if I'm wrong, into the discourse around contemporary art, is how that sort of took place, how that evolved. My suspicion is that they first entered in through the academy. You know, that would make the most sense.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
So how then do you think it, I mean, my guess, the sort of very short description of maybe what happened next is that art critics, maybe even more of ultimately gallery directors, you know, whoever was writing PR for, or, you know, artist statements or what have you for the artist. Certainly Peter Haley comes to mind, for whatever that's worth. But people who are sort of building the shticks, building the language around certain artists, were dipping into, you know, what was going on in the academy. And in some cases, some of those artists, you know, were crossing over. You know, they were working at universities themselves, you know, maybe taking on some of that language. I mean, do you want to put a finer point on what I'm trying to get at?
No, I think you're entirely right. There's a kind of dance between critical theory, which often is being produced on the edges of the university by people who are quite marginalized within the university, but then slowly becomes central to certain fields like cultural studies, literary analysis, to a certain extent art history, and then it gets folded into the kind of curriculum that's taught to art students and curators and others who will work in arts administration. And then in some ways it becomes a bit of the currency in those art worlds. And, you know, I don't want to say that's entirely a negative thing. I think that, you know, before we trained curators and artists in universities, I think it would actually be fair to say that the discourse and the individuals were much more conservative in a bad way. In, you know, they came from wealthy families, and some would argue they still do. Maybe we'll talk about that a little later. But I think that there's been a kind of democratization, a certain level of democratization, and a certain level of people bringing a kind of critical vantage to contemporary art and its political possibilities. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. but I think that it often goes without questioning the way in which even the critical impulse can be folded back into to markets in a certain way.
Right, right. Yeah, it seems that maybe there's sort of two sides to that. One is that you're bringing a more critical discourse to thinking about the work that is being made, that you're making, and so on. But at the same time, there, you know, to put it in a vernacular way, it feels a little artificially inflated sometimes. You know, like you're giving this gravitas to this work by applying, you know, Derrida or Baudrillard or whomever, when there's really no legitimate connection between the two.
Yeah. Or I think, I mean, I would still give it to the critic to prove to us in some way that there is a legitimate connection. But I would say that there's often overinflated political ambitions that are attributed to work or offered to work that for a lot of work that I think actually can't necessarily meet those ambitions.
Yeah. And I know you're going to hold the diplomatic line, as you sort of alluded to in our first conversation, but I will be less diplomatic or maybe a little more direct. And since I did mention Peter Haley, and I don't mention him by accident, I actually wrote in my graduate school, a graduate school paper, the more ambitious that I wrote, about two artists. One was Peter Haley and his use or affiliation with Baudrillard, and then the other was Mary Kelly and her affiliation with Lacan, from what I recall. And in any case, yeah, if you look at Peter Haley's work, if you're curious about Peter Haley and his background, he used a lot of Baudrillardian language to sort of justify / you know, build up his whole shtick with cells, you know, and connectivity and so on, which I think a lot of us can probably agree is just a justification for making abstract painting that is something more than just abstract painting, which it ultimately isn't. So for those of you who are curious, read more and do a little search, Baudrillard and Haley, and see what you come up with. All right. All that said, so Joseph Beuys is the first artist you talk about. Now, maybe I should read a little bit first, and then I can ask you about it when I do that. So on page 75, you write, starting in the late 1970s, dates are difficult to ascertain, West German sculptor and pioneer of performance and conceptual art Joseph Beuys used banknotes of various nations as a canvas and a distribution system for a series of enigmatic messages. Primary among them was Kunst equals Kapital, which he scrawled in marker on an unknown number of banknotes before passing them back into circulation, as well as on a diversity of other objects as well. Beuys' interventions have force because they leverage a number of contradictions in the reproduction of the circulation of capital. In the first place, as I have elsewhere argued, an additional function of money, apart from the above, is as a medium of the imagination. Hence, coins and banknotes have long been used as aesthetic canvases, although usually canvases monopolized by the powerful, used to circulate images of rulers or of national symbols, aimed at insisting on the legitimacy of their sovereignty and their unifying powers over a population. Yet the nation-state's reliance on currency as a vehicle for the reproduction of an imagined community can at times contradict the needs of the capitalist interests that usually stand behind the state, who, as was the case in both the U.S. and West Germany in the late 60s, were experiencing territorial limits to the expansion of accumulation. Before I read a little bit more from your bit about Beuys, I just want to let you talk some, and I'll cue it up by saying that, like, as with me, as with I think a lot of people listening, people associate Beuys with his performance, particularly the one with the wolf and the blanket, and probably aren't aware of the fact that he worked with dollar notes. So I guess maybe I could just start out with a question. To what extent do you think his work with banknotes was an influence on later artists, you know, compared to the way that his performance work was much more of an, perhaps much more of an influence?
I don't know exactly. I mean, I think certainly reading through the work of artists who have worked with money, often they reference Boys' intervention, especially those who are working in Europe. Mm. I think he's one of the first to really seize upon the canvas of a note and transform a banknote into a work of art simply by kind of adding his own imprinter, his signature. But I'm not sure. I'm not really an art historian. I couldn't necessarily say exactly how, sure. measure the influence of that particular intervention. I think in the case of his entire oeuvre, it's very much connected to a series of lectures he gave and books that he wrote and interventions he made more generally that were tied into this kind of great kind of cosmic theory he had, which is kind of crystallized for most of us in his famous phrase that, everyone is an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And as I go on to argue, I think in this chapter, something I think, and I would be willing to be proved wrong by Boy's expert, but I think what's going on in these works is his sense that within money is our own sort of creative potential handed back to us. An observation made, 70 years before by Marcel Mauss and other philosophers, but that there's something, even though we take money to be this kind of mundane thing in our life, totally uncreative, just a very material and materialist artifact, somehow it has within it our creative potential as a species and our creative potential as members of the society that means that he can make this kind of equivalence between art and capital. That he's somehow unlocking, or to use a terminology I use later in the book, decrypting some mm-hmm. sort of hidden power within it.
Mm. Now, one other thing that I'm thinking about him regarding perhaps the money, perhaps just more generally, is that my understanding is that he was a bit of a celebrity. He was a cultural force in Germany, not anything like in the North America, artists. Whether from that time or now. And I wonder if then in turn his Kunst equals capital, project or any others like it were something that, really made a cultural impact in some way or were noticed by a big portion of the population. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know a huge amount about German history at that time, so I don't know if I could make a categorical statement on it. But I do think that it was, and he was certainly a very influential figure.
Mm.
I mean, it's important to remember that, Germany at this time was still divided. And it was the period in which he was working from the, he was working before this, but, the period when he became extremely influential from the sort of mid to late 60s up until the 1980s was a period when a new generation was coming of age whose parents had quite literally often been Nazis, and mm-hmm. they were sort of coming to a recognition of the horrors that and the kind of legacy they'd been born into, and also people really trying to think through questions of socialism and communism that would avoid the kind of state terrorist nightmare of the East German experiment. So I think he, in his kind of his weird mix of a kind of penchant for direct democracy and a kind of shamanic impulse,
mm-hmm.
where I think he became quite influential, but he was such a difficult figure to really understand in some ways and to follow along with. I think that he gained followers and lost followers over the years quite frequently.
Mm.
There wasn't what you might call like a real consistent group of, that hung on his every word.
Okay. Well, let me just on that note finish a bit that I wanted to get to that you wrote about him a little bit further along. You wrote, all of these contradictions played into the success and perhaps the motivation of Boys' intervention. He capitalized on historically specific ambient skepticism and seized capitalist money's own essential qualities to make a distributed intervention that destabilized money's own influence on the imagination to revalorize the imagination. In so doing, Boys echoed and contributed to a broader moment of optimism toward the power of the imagination common to the new left political movements and the period's counterculture, which encouraged the radical imagination as a means to combat the conservative and establishmentarian idiom of the post-war capitalism. So before we move on, I just wanted to see if you could maybe use this opportunity, as we briefly talked about last time, to get more into this radical imagination. I mean, I don't think we can or you can talk too much about it, and you know, to in terms of introducing it to us as a concept, you know, as maybe one of the solutions to, as one of the strategies, you know, against financialization that you write about throughout the book.
Sure. Well, the notion of the radical imagination I'm working with here is very indebted to the French and Greek philosopher Cornelius Castoriadis. And what's important about his approach is he's not saying radical as a kind of euphemism or proxy for saying good or hopeful. Mm. He's really using radical as a means to get at the Latin root of the word, which is the word for root. So his theory of the radical imagination is something that's at the heart and at the kind of core of both us as human subjects and at the core of society. And it's this constant force of exploration, of experimentation, of disruption, of challenge that periodically erupts like a volcano. But then the sort of magma that it releases, this incredibly destructive, super hot, molten substance, solidifies. And it solidifies into our sense of identity on the level of the individual, and it solidifies into social institutions on the level of society as a whole. But even though it might solidify, it can erupt again and sort of sweep away the solidified remnant. So there's a kind of view here that everything we think is constant and stable in our society is actually the product of our imagination, and it can very easily be disrupted or dislodged. So a call to the radical imagination is a call to kind of remember our own creative and imaginative powers to create a society and to create ourselves as subjects within it, mm-hmm. and to call up the specter of a kind of disruption or destruction as well.
Mm-hmm. To what extent, you know, as you're talking about this, to the extent that there's some shared thinking, some, you know, that our thoughts, our thoughts about our imagination, if you will, are somehow bleeding across time and space. I know this sounds starting to sound a little hokey, but I'm just wondering if, as you've thought and written about this, there is some kind of, for lack of a better word, New Agey element to it at all. You know, like ESP, you know, school of thought, you know what I mean? Or am I overly reading into, am I taking some of this a little too literally, do you think?
I think it's an honest mistake, mm-hmm. because Castoriadis is writing at a time that, where there is a huge amount of interest. I mean, he's writing in the mid to late 60s, and there's a lot of interest in this time at the power of the imagination, and many of the explanations for the power of the imagination do make recourse to these kind of New Agey ideas about transcendental forces or cosmic forces or what have you. But Castoriadis's approach and our approach as well is very rigorously materialist. We're really not interested in things that we can't kind of observe. Castoriadis is a kind of mixture of a Marxist materialism and then a Freudian materialism as well. So he's really thinking about what it is that animates the social subject and really looking at the way that social institutions are held in place through human behaviors. And let me give you an example. Mm. Like, you know, the art world itself, the thing that we call art, and I think we discussed this a little bit in our last conversation, is an artificial and historically constituted category. Art as we understand it, which is like when I say the word art, most people think about some French guy drinking himself to death while painting oil canvases in Paris in the 19th century. That is a historically and socially constituted idea that's in our head. And the idea that art is the sort of individual expression of individual creative genius is only about 200 or 300 years old. Mm-hmm. It's very, very recent. And yet, to us, it feels eternal. And in fact, we ascribe sort of metaphysical power to this thing that we call art, and we imagine it's been around forever. But we as a society essentially created this category we call art, and we perpetuate this category we call art by a kind of unspoken, unacknowledged choice that we're making. And that choice is held in place not by any sort of cosmic power. It's held in place by institutions, the art world, mm-hmm. the art criticism world, all of the different institutions, galleries, museums, art collectors, who together, without any sort of prearranged agreement, reproduce this category. It doesn't mean to say that the works of individual geniuses are any less important or any less significant or we should like them any less. But it is to say that we are holding in place a social institution through a kind of collective work of the imagination. And that's the case for almost every social institution. It's the case for what we imagine to be normal, quote-unquote normal marriage, or what we imagine to be the police, or what we imagine to be political governance in the form of the state. All of those things are real. They have real material expression in our society. But on some fundamental level, they're held in place by this work of the imagination. And that work of the imagination is deeply material because it's enfolded in the way that we as a society cooperate, how we produce goods and services and distribute them to one another, and the sort of social roles and actions that we take as individuals.
So then in that model, is the radical imagination sort of thinking beyond those traditional models, thinking outside of the box?
Precisely. The kind of signature moment of the radical imagination is realizing that everything in our society is constructed and that we are mm-hmm. co-constructing it all the time mm-hmm. and taking a skeptical approach to that.
And then
if we are constructing it, we could construct it otherwise.
Right. And then that in turn is a connection to art that is untraditional, perhaps radical.
Yeah, quite.
Right. Okay. And then we can segue with that into the next artist, which I'm very excited to get to, Hans Hacke, who people, if they're familiar with, will know him for his intervention, his institutional critique. The way that I first remember hearing about him is that he had this piece that was a list of all of the benefactors, you know, the people on the board at, you know, who were also connected with supporting South African oil or the government or both. That's a vague description, but that's the gist of it. And so this is not too dissimilar. And stop me anytime, Max, if you want to take a break mm-hmm. or jump in. So page 80, Hacke applied to a juried exhibition of works from emerging artists, which is pretty amazing in itself, to present a piece that would encourage audience participation. At the time, this was a relatively new and provocative concept, though one that is now old hat and, as we shall see, almost compulsory. MoMA had become a popular recreational and educational destination, thanks in part to a growing educated urban middle class, in part to the rise of tourism, and in part to the largesse of the U.S. government and capitalist class, eager to promote the concept of Western, quote, modern art as part of a Cold War propaganda offensive. In Hacke's proposed piece, MoMA visitors would be asked to cast a vote in a transparent yes or no ballot box regarding a topical current event. But Hacke only revealed the question at the last minute. Quote, would the fact that Governor Rockefeller has not denounced President Nixon's Indochina policy be a reason for you not to vote for him in November, unquote. In addition to being scion to the Standard Oil and Chase Bank corporate empire, Nelson Rockefeller was a major New York and Washington Republican, a three-time candidate for the party's presidential nomination, and a frequent appointee to leading security and military committees under the Nixon administration, thanks in part to his longtime friendship with and support for White House National Security Advisor and later Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Before taking up his public duties in Washington and Albany, Rockefeller had served as a longtime governor of the MoMA. At the time of Hacke's poll, both his brother and sister-in-law were trustees. The considerable pressure the Rockefellers and their allies collectively brought to bear was not sufficient to convince the curator to remove Hacke's piece from the show, though it did lead to the curator's dismissal several months later. Hacke meticulously kept records of the visitors to the museum and the piece, as well as the vote tallies. yes, won handily. And that, I'm just going to say as an aside, is despite the fact there were quite a lot of double negatives going on. Haka's intervention was a candid and forthright attempt to set a trap for money that would force it to reveal itself as the sine qua non of the museum. It was also part of a series of actions that targeted MoMA during the Vietnam War and that sought to call attention to the complicity of art and culture in the reproduction of American capitalism and imperialism. Yet it was also a moment when modern art itself, as an institution writ large, developed an appetite for social critique, hence the inclusion of Haka and other radical artists in the exhibition. Their ability to occupy that space and make their radical interventions was due to a set of contradictions in the institutional reproduction of capital that Haka's piece sought to illuminate. Continuing just a little bit later, the rewards that the ruling classes obtain from collecting modern art are not only at the level of subjectivity and community, no doubt important. Sitting on the same museum boards or going to the same gala events offers otherwise competitive capitalists an opportunity to collaborate, make common cause, and form alliances and agreements in the interests of their class as a whole, something that can be otherwise be difficult to orchestrate given that capitalism crucially depends on their competition with one another. Meanwhile, posing themselves as patrons of the arts and therefore facilitators of the higher human pursuits in some senses buys capitalists indemnity or absolution for the crimes of exploitation that begat their wealth. Further still, the canon of art, focused exclusively on the products of white European men, almost all from the elite class, creates a field of ideological legitimacy around this demographic's right to rule everyone else. Their monopolization of the narrative of artistic triumph as the apogee of human achievement justifies their supposedly benevolent rule over women, people of color, colonized populations, and the working class. Finally, art collecting and connoisseurship offers a number of financial rewards. While art objects are notoriously illiquid assets, they have long been used as vehicles for the circulation of capital, standing as collateral for loans or as significant components of the estates of the wealthy. Donations or loans of works to museums not only earns opportunities for self-congratulation and the admiration of one's peers, it can also offer lucrative tax breaks and opportunities for tax fraud. And more generally, investment in the field of art, especially contemporary art, offers the wealthy a sort of para-financial game, a parody version of real markets where one's swollen psychosocial muscles of financial speculation get to stretch in a gymnasium of the imagination. So there's a lot more to go, but I want to take a break here. And for starters, I don't know if you were able to get too much into the weeds, but anything more about the curator's dismissal several months later that you recall?
I don't recall. You know, I wrote this chapter a couple of years ago now. Yeah, I don't remember the story entirely.
Right.
But Haka has written about it and in many interviews and gone over the story. And I believe that curator, too, has mentioned it. He went on to do other important things.
Okay. Good to know. I think that's an important detail. So without necessarily asking a question, I just want to point out that this, to me, feels like ground zero for institutional critique in the art world, and in art history, for that matter. Is there anything that I read that you wrote or just generally that you want to get a little more into the weeds about or that comes to mind after hearing all that, rehearing all that?
You know, I think that passage that you read really comes from me asking this question, which vexes me throughout the entire book, which is like, what does the ruling class want from art? Mm. It's clear that they do want art, and it's clear that they want contemporary art, and it's clear that they want contemporary art that's critical. Mm-hmm. So what is it that it gives them? And there's a whole range of explanations that we get that date back to, you know, Marx, but certainly Pierre Bourdieu, the great French sociologist, has a lot to say, and many, many following in his footsteps. And so in that passage you read, I sort of enumerate a number of things that the rich, the 1%, the ruling class want. the one thing I'll say about it is I think Hakka is a Marxist, and he's very well read. So I think all of these things are, or many of these things are certainly going through his head. My experience recently is that, unfortunately, a lot of artists who are doing institutional critique today are not as well read as Hakka.
Mm.
And I think it leads people into a number of problems because, as I am alluding to in this passage, and I explore later in the book, there's a way in which institutional critique, which was originally this form of agitation, has really in some ways been folded into the sort of remit of the modern contemporary museum and even the art world and even the art market in certain senses. And I think, I mean, and this might just be because of my own political and theoretical orientations, I actually think it's more important than ever to go back to some of the language that I'm employing here, and that was certainly in Hakka's mind, which is a language that comes from Marxism, that this has to do with the reproduction of a capitalist class. They are driven by contradictory desires, not because they're bad people necessarily or because they're stupid, but because of their place within a system of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that when we understand the contradictions that drive their behavior, we have a much better chance of understanding what art's place is within that system and then the remit for rebellion within that.
I'm sorry, can you clarify, you use this word remit a couple of just now. What does that mean exactly?
It means like the kind of space, the possibility, the calling of resistance.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thought that occurs to me when you talked at the beginning about what do these supporters, these benefactors want in terms of, I don't know if you use the term radical art, but certainly ambitious art, maybe something along those lines, is that we're talking about the 1970s, early 1970s here. And so certainly then, and even to some extent now, but certainly less now, but still, you know, the collector class, when they say that, if they were to say we want radical art, you know, maybe that's a more radical form of abstraction or sculpture or what have you. But when it comes to something this radical, I think it's, you know, it's beyond the scope of their imagination, to use that word another way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in a strange way, I mean, with the benefit of history behind us, and this is not a slight on Hakka in any way, the power of an institution like MoMA to name those works under its roof as contemporary, its power to create the illusion of contemporaneity, which leads to the market value of the artists who are collected there.
Mm.
In a weird way, that power depends precisely on artists like Hakka, who are creating things that are completely uncommodifiable. Like, you can't really sell this piece.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, you know, it's not what the art collectors want. But in a weird way, it lends a certain power to
mm-hmm.
the institution, even though it's making a critique of the institution.
Right.
And I'm not saying that it's, you know, aha, finally capitalism has outsmarted Hans Hakka. I think Hakka has always known very clearly what he's doing. And I think, on the whole, his work is offers more in terms of critique and radicalism than it takes away.
Mm-hmm.
But it is to say that even in an art world where, you know, yeah, there's no billionaire who's going to spend $50 million on a performance that antagonizes the art world, but they may sit on the board of a museum that funds such a performance, or
mm-hmm.
they may be a patron of a commercial gallery that also represents that artist who's doing the radical work. And in a strange way, the radical work ends up being part of the same ecosystem or economy as the, you know, bauble for billionaire stuff on canvas.
Right. And that indeed is one of your thrusts throughout the book, is that art is money, money is art. You ultimately can't separate the two. The more legitimacy, you know, or the more acting is going on, the more it gets folded into the system.
In many ways, yeah. And I don't say that as a kind of fatalistic,
mm-hmm.
You know, sort of dirge-like,
mm-hmm. right?
depressive statement. I just think that it forces artists to be much more cunning and savvy about how they approach interventions within this field of art, And more importantly, because ultimately art is not really the biggest thing on my mind most of the time, I think it has weird lessons to teach all of us as we struggle within this financialized system that seems capable of incorporating and profiting from practically anything.
Mm. So, as you say, you know, art is not always at the forefront of your mind. You know, as a cultural critic, there are other things in the culture to look at. And you do talk about, as we briefly talked about last time, what art can do that other media or, you know, forms cannot. I just want to clarify. So is this example that we're talking about, you know, where you have this institutional critique and, you know, the awareness that the artist has in the way these things are going to play out, is that an important analog for other things that you're looking at in the world?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what was so... So, I mean, Haka is working in a context that's now 45 years past. Mm. So the situation of capitalism and the situation of the capitalist class has changed somewhat. But I think what Haka shows us is someone who really cunningly looks and unflinchingly looks at the institutional ecology in which he as an artist finds himself and thinks about what power is doing, those people with power are doing, what they want, and what sort of freedom he has. And then he very carefully and exactly makes the most painful attack on them. And I think that sort of thinking is important increasingly for all of us because, you know, me as an academic or anyone really who's working in this economy is caught up in a position of mandatory complicity as mm-hmm. Haka was at mm-hmm. that time, as artists are today. Mm-hmm. And if we're all caught up in a system of mandatory complicity in a system that's objectively and metaphorically killing us, that kind of thinking that he has, I think, becomes increasingly important.
When you used the word painful a moment ago, do you remember what you meant by that?
Well, simply that I think, you know, Haka could have done many different sorts of interventions here, and he could have gone about this project in many different ways. And I think he goes about it in the way that is going to be the most agonizing for Rockefeller and his friends on the mm-hmm. board, which mm-hmm. is they don't want to come in, they don't want to be seen to be coming in and closing down a young artist, a young critical artist, because their investment, the collectors and Rockefeller, their investment in MoMA is to create a temple of modern art, to precisely produce this critical contemporaneity I've been speaking about.
Right.
So if they essentially come in and slap him down, they're in some ways killing the goose that lays the golden egg. It's that is the thing that's going to add value to the paintings in the collection and the artifacts in the collection, but it's also what they're invested in the institution for. They want to be seen in the world as promoting this thing called modern art because it makes them feel good about themselves. It makes them look like they're promoting freedom and
right.
experimentation and the capitalist economy and blah, 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 blah. So they can't necessarily afford to appear heavy-handed and censorious to, you know, shut him down. So he's kind of crafted this intervention where he's going to bring something into their space, into their temple, ultimately, that they're not going to be able to shut down, but that's going to do a kind of counter-ideological work that, you know, really defames Rockefeller's claims to be this kind of great man of American democracy by bringing in precisely the sore spot, which is his continued support for, at the time, the Vietnam War and the kind of form of capitalist imperialism that he was a great beneficiary of and pusher of. So I think there's a kind of way that Haka here creates a certain kind of pain, but it's not just a pain for the institution, it's a pain for particular people behind the institution as
well. Right. You mentioned that this was in the past, that we're looking at a past of 40-some years, you know, of institutional critique and this piece in particular. And one of the thoughts that I had was... Because you talked about it, the language that you used almost sort of suggested, you know, this is old hat, you know, in fact, as you wrote in the book. But my sort of emotional reaction to the way that you put that was, oh, yeah, well, now people are just ready to sell out, you know. This is
right.
This kind of thing. Yeah, no, there's no time for institutional critique. We just want to sell out. So, yeah, that's really, you know, he's just so sincere and... you know, an old school. We're not like that anymore.
I think that's true. I mean, I do think that there is a generation of younger artists who are taking action in a number of ways. I'm thinking about, for instance, like right now there's a bunch of protests against the Whitney because one of the board members is
right.
produced a bunch of tear gas that's being used at the border and being sold around the world. There was a group in London that managed to get British Petroleum to quit their sponsorship of the Turbine Hall exhibitions. And that has included a lot of artists who've done kind of works of institutional critique within those spaces, too. So I do think there is a generation that is that is definitely working within the legacy of Haka as well. That's not so eager to sell out. But
sure.
the situation has indeed changed in the sense that, now there's a much hungrier appetite for critical, provocative artwork in various ways than there was in Haka's time.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot more to fight against now, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly.
And the other thing that occurred to me as you talked about the intelligence and the well-readedness of Haka in contrast to other artists working in institutional critique is that was a really important point. And the subtext I'm taking away from your comment is that you've seen a lot of quote-unquote radical art and or institutional art that has failed, and it is apparent to you that it has failed because the artist or artists doing it are in over their heads in terms of what they're trying to do. And as far as knowing their history, knowing the Marxism and other schools of thought and so on.
Yeah, I think it's not just common to artists. I mean, I think the massive problem with our world today, which may be our ultimate undoing, is that people generally take surface appearances for what's at the root, especially when it comes to power.
Mm-hmm.
So we see what we think is power on the surface, and we sometimes don't look beyond it and realize that behind the thing that looks powerful is maybe something else or another form of power, or maybe there's a logic or a system, or maybe people have thought through this before and we have something to learn from past generations. So, I think it's a big problem, not just for artists, but for all of us at this point in time.
Okay, well, that's an important distinction to draw. I appreciate that. Let me just finish up this, because I feel like there's some stuff that you wrote that maybe will echo a little bit what you were talking about. You wrote, continuing on Haka, whereas most large, well-heeled institutions earn their pedigree and prestige from acquiring unambiguous cultural treasures that have stood the test of time, MoMA and many other institutions afterwards staked its legitimacy and the status of its donors and custodians on celebrating the new for its display of a properly financial acumen, for identifying and seizing upon emerging potentials for future return. Again, this is echoing just what you said. This obsession with the new had, of course, long been a feature of capitalist accumulation, especially in the realm of technology, which might give a firm a competitive edge. But until the post-war period, it was generally only the high-risk bourgeois art collectors or institutions that would take a risk on novelty. Legitimacy for someone like early 20th century financial magnate J.P. Morgan, who collected rare and ancient manuscripts, came from acquiring, collecting, and quote-unquote protecting the great treasures of the past. As the civil rights movement morphed into the Black Power movement, radicalized subjects of empire rejected the reproduction of racial hierarchies in the institutions of prisons, law enforcement, schooling, health, housing, and universities. Second wave feminism and queer liberation likewise rejected the institutions of gender, marriage, and sexuality that were central to the post-war mythos of middle-class suburban happiness. Students were rising up against conservative educational institutions. This was a moment where the bluff was called on the forms of freedom and prosperity promised as part of the post-war deal that, along with anti-communist witch hunts in the 1950s, had saved capitalism from collapse and uprising. Haka's intervention then capitalized on these contradictions not only to tweak the nose of power in its own temple, but also to suggest a new set of priorities for art: politically engaged, participatory, explicitly challenging to social norms, even at times purposefully aesthetically ugly. His is a reflection of and a contribution to a more widespread revolt within and against social institutions of the reproduction of capitalism that insist they serve the reproduction of radical democracy. Well written.
Oh, thank you.
Is there anything that you want to add to any of that? Between the lines, perhaps?
No, I think that's fairly on the surface, although some of the sentences are a bit long. Simply to say that, you know, I think in these three artists that are the first part of this chapter, I'm trying to position them in a moment of great social upheaval, that my mentor, Randy Martin, spoke about as the kind of these moments of great decolonization, both decolonization around the world and then decolonization of the self and of the subject in the global north. And that he argues that financialization is the kind of capitalism's response to these great movements of decolonization. And so I think in this part of the chapter, I'm trying to lay out the challenges to capitalism that then capitalism has to evolve or develop to kind of contain or meet. And that's the situation that we find ourselves in today, 45 years later.
I wonder if you use the term in talking about your mentor, decolonization of the self. And I don't know if I'm reading into this anywhere accurately, but I wonder if that's a good segue into Lee Lozano's project. Maybe you can just, without necessarily referring to her, what do you mean by that term, as opposed to the more widespread, you know, decolonization?
Well, for Martin, and I have to confess, I'm sort of quoting him in this, but I actually think decolonization might not be the best term for a number of reasons. But for him, the decolonization ultimately boils down to a desire for self-rule. So in the global south, countries that are emerging from colonialism, the political demand is for self-rule, to become independent nation states that democratically elect their government and have control over their own fate. In the global north, the decolonization that Martin is talking about has to do with a desire for self-rule of our own bodies and our own futures. So in the case of the feminist movement, which maybe ties into Lozano's work, this is part in the second wave feminism, is sort of a decolonization of, at least in Martin's framing, of women's experience, that they would have the right to determine for themselves and participate fully in society. But with Lozano and others, it's a radical feminism. So it's actually attempting to tear down patriarchal institutions and build a different kind of society as well. Now, I'll just say that as indebted as I am to Martin's work, I think it's very important to not toy with and make a metaphor of the concept of decolonization. I mean, I literally live in a place right now, Thunder Bay, Canada, where literal colonialism kills dozens, hundreds of indigenous people every year in terms of poverty, police violence. So I'm very sensitive to the idea that, you know, we would be borrowing this word to describe something else.
Right.
But I think there's something quite useful about the way that he uses it and this idea that decolonization has to be contained or controlled by capitalism. And that drives its next evolution into financialization that's still very useful.
Mm. Okay. Very good. Well, before I read from your Lee Lozano, and I'm very excited to do so because I think a lot of listeners maybe are vaguely familiar with her project or action of sort of dropping out of the art world, but are probably not familiar with the actual pieces that she made, including this one. And I'm just going to also mention that she mentions a couple of people who were took part in this performance or what have you action that she did, and one of them she mentions the last name is Kaltenbach, and that I'm pretty sure is Stephen Kaltenbach, who, for people who are longtime listeners of the show, may remember from my conversation with Roger White, who wrote a book called Art in the 21st Century. Kaltenbach is a guy who was involved in the sort of first generation of conceptual art in New York in the 60s, and then cut to many years later, was sort of living well outside the scene in Sacramento area, and so far that he at one point made this hyper-realist painting of his dying father that I believe is a big hit at the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento. So that's a lot of between the lines backstory. But all that said, on page 85, if you're reading along, so this starts with a note that's actually included in Lee Lozano's piece, and it goes like this. Note, at beginning of this piece, the jar contains bills of $5, $10, $20, about $585 worth, coiled in two or three packets around the inside of the jar, unbound. The money comes from Rolf Ricky from sale of painting Switch. Offer to guests coffee, Diet Pepsi, bourbon, glass of half and half, ice water, grass, and money. Open jar of real money and offer it to guests like candy. April 4th, 1969. These instructions to herself, you write, and to perhaps other future artists wishing to replicate the piece, are followed by a day-to-day journal of the results of the experiment from 4 April to 9 July, 1969, documenting the divergent responses of her studio's visitors, friends, and other artists to the piece. These responses range from whimsical to avaricious, from mirthful to furious. On April 27, quote, Kaltenbach takes all the money out of the jar when I offer it, examines all the money, and puts it all back in jar, says he doesn't need money now, unquote. On May 1, Warren C. Ingersoll refused. He got very upset about my, quote, attitude toward money, unquote. On May 23, quote, Paula Davies and Marilyn Lerner drop in unexpectedly. Neither take any money, but Paula says later she was controlling herself, unquote. On June 6, quote, Alan Serrett visits again and makes a piece of the money, which is now in two piles on the floor, each shaped similarly to a footstep by folding and molding to his hand. It looks good like that, and I'm going to leave it on the floor for a while, unquote. Real Money piece emerged several months after into Lozano's General Strike piece, within which she gave herself the instructions to, gradually but determinedly, avoid being present at official or public uptown functions or gatherings related to the art world in order to pursue investigations of total personal and public revolution. Exhibit in public only pieces which further sharing of ideas and information related to total personal and public revolution. That's the end of the description of that. It came several months before her more extreme, cryptic, and ultimately self-destructive decide to boycott women piece, in which she refused to communicate at all with women, and dropout piece, in which she essentially severed not only all ties to the art world, but also sought to break herself of all artistic habits, often with the assistance of alcohol and powerful narcotics. 1969 was arguably the height of Lozano's career by conventional measurements, culminating the following year in a career-defining solo show at New York's Whitney Museum. It preceded a period from 1972 to 81 when she essentially disappeared and after which she did not exhibit art or communicate with almost anyone outside her family until her death in 1999. For Lozano, a, quote, total personal and public revolution, unquote, perhaps meant more than just an avowed solidarity to particular causes or groups, and also more than creating propaganda for a cause. It appeared to imply a brutally rigorous personal practice, P-word, I should say, of reflexively interrogating power as it worked through everyday life, social intercourse, habitual patterns, evaluative expectations, and the gendered body. Hence, we can identify Lozano's work as a sort of militant research on the field of social reproduction and an almost desperate seeking out of the often painful yet fruitful contradictions therein. In that sense, Lozano here transforms herself into a kind of test pilot or experimental subject to explore the extreme implications of life in a patriarchal capitalist world. Here, Lozano fruitfully, if self-destructively, inhabits the subjectivity of the tragic artist whose uncompromising, if untimely, passion and drive makes them into the sacrificial offering of capitalism, denied the means of healthy, personal, bodily, and social reproduction. Now, there's a lot more that follows that I would maybe like to read as well, but I do want to just stop here, breathe, let you have a chance to get in, and preface it by saying that what is even more striking about this work to me is that Lozano was a painter, essentially an abstract painter, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. And here she was making this work. To me, I think if you really can wrap your head around it, that's pretty unfathomable, because that's kind of, as we talked about briefly in our last conversation, this idea of making radical work when you have been so conditioned in some, to some extent, in the realm of traditional art making, whatever that form may take, even if within, it's in when the radical limitations of that traditional art making, this is like an amazing paradigm shift.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think though she was even before it. She was sort of on the ground floor of the conceptual turn in in painting as well. You know, and I think that a lot of people make the comparison between her sort of instructions to herself and Saul LeWitt's instructions, oddly, to other people, which is also an interesting gender divide.
Right.
So there's a sense that I think artists were coming out of a very tactile and engaged makerly practice at that moment were really trying to distill that practice down into its most minimal and conceptual apparatus and then spell it out in a set of sort of rules. Or, you know, I think that that was very of the moment, and certainly of the moment of the people that she mentions coming to her studio. But I think it is really interesting because I think more recently conceptual art has turned away from being grounded in a kind of maker's process and has become much more politically involved. And it's, it's interesting to reflect on the fact that she, like LeWitt, came out of a very makerly sort of space.
Yeah, yeah. And, it, you know, just to dive a little bit further or refer back to the work itself, it's just really, I mean, what I love so much, among other things about this, is just it's such a beautiful anecdote. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, how, I mean, I guess you have to contextualize it as the early days of conceptualism in New York. You know, it was a close-knit community from what we've read. And so in that sense, you can kind of see the incubation potential, you know, of making work like this, you know, that it was like anything goes. And there was enough of a thoughtful audience around, you know, to make that happen. It's just hard to imagine now doing something like that because we're, you know, we're all on social media and so on. It's, and this is, you know, and this is so in the moment and so raw. It's, you know, you were to do this, anything like this piece now, people would, you know it would be in a complete vacuum and nobody would care. So it's, you know, it is really, sadly, a bit of a relic of the past when you think of it that way.
It's true, although I think we shouldn't necessarily imagine that people did care particularly at the time. I mean, I think most people cared. I mean, especially Lozano's gallerists and friends that she produced the paintings that, you know, had her have this kind of independent Whitney show at a time when very few women were getting such shows. They really wanted to see her fulfill her what they thought of as her artistic promise. And meanwhile, she's kind of, as you read the notebooks, that these pieces like the money piece and the dropout piece that are part of, they become increasingly obsessed with a kind of a furious purification of herself from the kind of taint of the art market and all of the systems of power entangled in it. So there's one way it's a very beautiful story, and another way it's, I think, quite a tragic story, because ultimately she can't find a space to survive and practice a kind of authenticity within the art world and you know, literally creates instructions to drop out and then follows through, you know, and follows through on instructions never to speak to women for years. And, you know, I think there's a lot here about, you know, ultimately she takes this ideal of the romantic artist as this iconoclast, this person who answers only to their own personal truth, to the most sort of to the extreme. And that's, you know, as always, it's a romantic story, but also a tragic story.
Yeah. And what else maybe can you say from what you read, you know, is informed her decisions and her choices in terms of ambition, madness, antisocial tendencies, you know, anything along those lines?
I mean, I think all of those were part of it. Her struggles with addiction were well known at the time and afterwards. I mean, I'm always very careful about a kind of about psychologizing the actions of anyone, but particularly artists.
Why are you careful?
I have, two reasons. One of them is I think that it often does a work of explaining away too easily artists' motivation.
Right.
When I think that one of the valuable things about dwelling with an artwork or an artist's biography and their work is precisely to have to become comfortable with not knowing about why they acted this way.
Mm-hmm.
And the second reason is connected is that I have long, and I joined many other sort of critical scholars in this, I've long suspected the categories that we use to describe what we today term mental illness to be inexact and often quite problematic.
Mm.
You know, we could say, for instance, that Lozano perhaps suffered from depression or perhaps suffered from bipolar disorder or a whole manner of other clinical diagnoses. But I think that those actually, in a weird way, hide more than they would reveal about what's going on. And in any case, risk delegitimizing the fact that she was ultimately correct on some level. The art world was a corrupt, venal, and stupid patriarchal place in many ways.
Right.
The claims of many of her contemporaries to be radicals, to be revolutionaries, were, as she pointed out at the time, often either naive or self-serving. And really, probably she was right that artists should just go, like every other worker, should go on general strike until the system came to a crashing halt.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, she chose to deal with those realities in terms of her own individual actions, and maybe that was the only avenue that was open to her at the time. But I would hate to psychologize her experience, because I think ultimately her analysis of the situation was entirely legitimate and correct.
Right.
Or almost entirely legitimate and correct.
Yeah, putting aside, you know, the I think those are excellent points about overly ascribing various mental illnesses and how that affects our perception of work and artists. But apart from all that, initially, you know, when you started to answer my question about when I said, why do you have that concern, I thought of immediately Van Gogh popped into my head.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, you know, she's like a modern day Van Gogh. But then I thought, no, that's not really the best way to put it. Maybe the best way to put it is that she was an art world martyr.
In many ways, yeah. Although I think, and I think interestingly, I've seen that her name is appearing much more frequently these days with a kind of martyr, a sort of moniker to it. But, you know, I think if Lozano was still with us, she would swear at us and say that she never wanted to be a martyr. She wanted to be a revolutionary. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, was she not both?
I wonder. I mean, I think that there's a certain meaning in our society, unfortunately, that gets ascribed to women who are understood as martyrs, that in a weird way, in the same way as using a psychologizing language can in a weird way make them still more victim than agent.
Right.
And I think she would probably want to resist that name, though I think in a certain sense I definitely understand it.
Well, to push back on that a little bit, I mean, I can't think of any men who have done anything similar. So she's really the only one. She just happens to be a woman who's done this kind of work. So I don't mean to, you know, discredit her by calling her a martyr, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah. No, I totally see what you mean.
Yeah. To get back to what you wrote about her in the book, there is something that I really did want to get to specifically. And this is for if you're reading along the bolded section a little further along, you write, for Lozano, a, quote, total personal and public revolution, unquote, would then require interrogating money as both the medium of capital's reproduction in circulation and the medium of social reproduction, not only questioning its power to orchestrate productive labor in the public sphere, but also reproductive labor in the private. While it is difficult to find data to validate such a claim, numerous anecdotes from art world insiders I spoke with while researching this book confirm that little has changed in this regard in the intervening years since Lozano's experiments. So now you alluded to this in the last comments that you were making, but I'm very curious to know what kind of art world insiders you spoke with, Max. And I think this is important juncture to maybe home in a little bit more on you, because to characterize you from our last conversation, you know, you are an academic coming to this, taking a research approach to this work, you know, this financialized money-based work. And, you know, you only saw a modest amount of the works in person. So when you have interactions with art world insiders, who are they and to what extent are you having them?
Oh, yeah. Well, I made a decision early on in the research for this book that I wasn't going to do a kind of classic social science approach where I would have gotten, you know, I would have developed a schedule of questions and actually done intensive interviews with individuals. So what I'm speaking to you now about, as I indicate in that passage, is anecdotal. It's what sort of emerged in the conversations over a coffee or over a beer or, you know, when I asked a follow-up question to various people at various moments for research in the book. So the people in general, I spoke to a lot of professors in art schools who've watched generations of students go by and are engaged in various levels with the art world, either at the commercial level or on boards of organizations or studying it. I spoke to many people who worked in both world-class and regional art museums and galleries. I spoke to some commercial gallerists. I spoke to people who work for art fairs. I spoke to people who work for art storage and handling facilities. I spoke to a lot of artists and a lot of critics as well. So it was quite a range. I mean, it's not my world. I don't hang out with sort of art world insiders socially, and I don't live anywhere near them. But in the course of doing the research for the book, I got into a lot of these conversations. And the thing that I think, as this passage indicates, that was revealed is that there's a dense network of familial and social connections that hold that economy and ecosystem together. Mm. And those are very difficult to quantify. But they're, you know, like all great sociological open secrets, something that everyone knows and nobody can exactly point to.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm still more interested in, you know, you mentioned the various categories of individuals that you spoke with in the research process. And I imagine that with the museum people, and I don't know to what extent you spoke with gallery people, but with museum people, that they can be a little bit hard to pin down. And being that at least in this book, you didn't, there was almost nobody that you mentioned by name, how difficult was it to get access to them? And, you know, knowing that they weren't going to be quoted in this book.
Well, in the sense that they knew they weren't going to be quoted, it was a little bit easier. Oh. I mean, I didn't choose to do a kind of research project where I set out a schedule of interviews and really systematically interviewed, you know, 10 museum directors or something like that. So a lot of the discussions I had were incidental or at events or, you know, this sort of thing. But people, I mean, it's funny. I think the art market and perhaps the art world in a weird way runs on a certain degree of candor, a certain degree of gallows humor, a certain degree of cynicism that means that people are actually quite eager to talk. Because I think this is true of any institution where people their daily life puts them in contact with a lot of different human beings and a lot of irreconcilable contradictions where, you know, things don't make any sense. So, you know, you have good art being, you know, crated away to art storage facilities and never seen by human eyes. And you have bad art elevated to the level of, you know, massive global superstardom simply because it benefits some billionaire's particular desire that day or their financial machinations. And you have situations where the wrong people succeed, yet everyone needs to believe on some level that it's a meritocracy and, you know, good work gets rewarded. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance, and I think the way that most people in the art economy, especially because many of them are extremely highly educated, the way they deal with that cognitive dissonance is by drinking and gossiping.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I still think it's interesting. I'm interested in the real particulars, and I imagine that I understand that people were happy to talk with you. I think still, it was relevant and important where you were coming from, you know, that you were doing a book on something relatively relevant to them, and that they weren't just talking to some, you know, random gallery goer or something like that. You know what I mean? It is a little surprising to me that museum people would want to talk to you without, you know, having their PR people involved. But I guess I can see that they appreciated the opportunity to have an intelligent, willing ear to hear what, you know, their particular take on things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in another time in another place, the other word for researcher is therapist.
So, right.
You know.
Yes.
People have a lot they need to work through.
Yeah. Got it. Well said. Okay, so the next section, is this the title of a chapter, actually? Do you remember? Is it Cognitive Capitalism? Is that another chapter, or are we still in the same chapter, too?
I think we're still on the same chapter.
Okay.
It sort of is a way of describing that sort of transition from the 1973 moment to now.
Okay, great. Thank you. So from page 94, you write, in tandem with the deindustrialization of the global north and the rise of new communication and production technologies, the notion and the reality of the mass workers and mass social institutions gave way to an archipelago of sites of consumption and labor, as well as a shift toward forms of employment that are increasingly, quote, precarious, short-term, part-time, contract-based, reaching its apotheosis in today's platform-mediated gig economy. The new model worker is not the lifelong blue-collar company man, but, ironically enough, the flighty artist whose allergy to long-term fixed relationships allows them to design their own career based on talent and passion. The shift toward this new form of capitalism has equally demanded shifts on the level of social reproduction, subjectivity, and everyday life. Increases in consumerism make up for the decay of social institutions, collective forms of insurance, such as those provided by community cohesion and the welfare state, and compulsory labor mobility. The aforementioned rise of the service sector is both a numeric reality with more and more tasks related to the reproduction of social life privatized and made into commodities, and a general condition. Even, quote, productive labor is seen as a, quote, service to be rented. So I wanted to particularly read that paragraph because it's so attached to a lot of what you've covered and your sympathies towards people in precariousness. You know, that's a word that happens elsewhere in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So unless there's nothing else you want to add to that, I can jump to this next artist. But go ahead if you do.
No, I think that's, yep.
Okay, great.
Yeah, let's
okay, very good. Okay, so now is Gough representing one of the three circa 2008 artists? Am I getting that right, or was it?
Yeah?
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're finally getting to the 35 year later artists, and the first one is Zach Gough, a Canadian, thankfully enough. So for those reading along on page 101, on three occasions in 2014, Zach Gough, a Canadian social P word. I'm going to, by the way, Max, continue to use the P word artist because
right,
it's used so frequently, orchestrated a demonstrative game played with Bordeaux, an invented currency, at key gatherings of fellow social P word artists and researchers in New York, Melbourne, and Portland, Oregon. The rules were as follows. At the beginning, the currency is distributed in correlation with the hierarchy's president of the conference. Keynotes get the most, presenters and panelists get lots, artists get some, attendees get just a bit, and the general public get none at all. People are invited to exchange the currency for information and items of social value in whatever way they see fit. Email addresses, ideas, inspiration, influence, contact information, inside jokes, URL links, website coordinates, PDFs are bought, sold, and traded with Bordeaux. Participants are encouraged to discuss how they generate power in an art context, who accumulates social capital and socially engaged artworks. At the end of the conference, participants use the accumulated wealth of Bordeaux to bid in an auction for prizes rich in social capital. And I'm going to ask you about this. What prizes after we get through this? Like Lozano, Gough is using money or its proxy to create an artificial ritual that reveals the underlying rituals of value, commodification, and neoliberal subject formation germane to a financialized moment. The project aims to reveal the economy of social and cultural capital already present within the discipline and at conferences for socially engaged art. It also shows how our economies of power mimic or operate under similar rules to our financial economy. Further, the project presents currency as an abstracted representation of our social relationships and explores the danger of quantifying value. Gough's intervention resonates with recent commentary from institutional critique pioneer Andrea Fraser that calls even critical and radical art to task for its participation in financialization. In the face of the Occupy movement and the specter of so many critical artists declaring fidelity to or creating work reflecting the struggle against the proverbial 1%, Fraser systematically explores how the art world from which such work emerges and within which it circulates is saturated by the money and influence of the financial subclass. It's not simply that financiers or those enriched by financial wealth represent the lion's share of art collectors and continue to monopolize the boards of art museums, galleries, institutions, and funding bodies. It is that this funding and the entanglements of the art world with high finance exert a gravitational pull on all manner of artistic institutions and initiatives, including those that avowedly, often hyperbolically, seek to reject and escape this influence. The history of 20th century art shows us that yesterday's abject outsiders are today's art world innovators and the creators of tomorrow's most desirable commodities. And before we go, if we do, on a little bit further, I want to finally let you jump in. And maybe first by answering, so the Bordeaux to bid in an auction for prizes rich in social capital. What's an example of one of those prizes, if you recall?
I don't know. I remember asking Zach Gow, the artist, when we spoke about the piece, but I can't remember what
okay.
they were.
Okay.
I think they were things like, if I remember correctly, and maybe he can correct us by writing in or something like that.
Yeah.
It would be something like, you know, you'd get to go and have like a dinner with the museum director, or you'd get to have a kind of signed book by someone who was at the conference, something like that.
Okay. Did you happen to be at the conference?
No.
Okay.
No.
So I have a two-pronged observation, and then I'll let you take over for a bit. And that is that this is a fascinating project and event that he's organized, and it's really interesting to think about sort of how in real life, you know, social hierarchies and social interactions and social capital is organized and distributed. It sounds at the same time absolutely excruciating to potentially take part in. No?
He reports that I think most people kind of had fun, but I think it was that particular kind of fun that is very uncomfortable.
Right. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, so I don't know if you want me to try to give you a specific question, but is there anything, what are some of the takeaways from this project that for him or you, you know, through your conversations with him?
I think it's a project that's nicely, I mean, it is, I think, in and of itself quite brilliant. I think it's also indicative of a generation of artists who are, I think, in the tradition of Haka, doing institutional critique on with a level of sophistication that I really appreciate. Because I think what Gao is doing in this piece is creating a kind of quite a charismatic participatory spectacle that reveals precisely the kind of thick complexity of the art world, or the particular corner of the art world that he's dealing with,
right?
And really does make people uncomfortable. I think maybe what's different, and the reason that I also selected it as indicative of this kind of 2008 crisis moment, or the moment after it, as contrasting to the Haka piece in the late 60s. Is that the power that is being illuminated here, the kind of structures or architecture of power, is one that's not simply invested in the institution and the personage of the kind of rich patron or benefactor or board member. It's actually a power that's been infused in and suffused through the lives of every single person in the room. So this is a much more sort of Foucauldian notion of power from Michel Foucault, where it's not just that power comes from whoever has the money or who has the kind of keys to the state. Power is exercised by everyone and exercised on everyone. And I think that this project does a nice job of revealing that for our times.
Mm, right, right. Here are a couple of follow-up questions or thoughts. What kind of people took part in these events, as far as you can tell? I mean, I would suspect that they are part of the socially engaged art community, the participatory art community, as opposed to the greater art worlds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everyone knew the name Bourdieu and got the pun of the title. These were social practice or socially engaged art conferences.
Right.
So these were people who were already came with a great deal of criticism towards the typical art market and art world,
right,
and already were sort of grappling with these issues to begin with.
So that leads me to state that or suspect that this was a case of preaching to the converted, at this event. And were it not for your book to, share it with, a wider audience that what went on here, was a great exploration, a great experiment in, how these social hierarchies play out. But also I'll just add that as I'm sort of digesting this a bit more, in particular thinking back to the hierarchy of who got, the most tickets, or what were they called, that people were handed out?
The
Bourdieu. Who got the most Bourdieu based on that hierarchy? I mean, this is a perfect analog for what goes on regularly at art fairs these days, which is, mm-hmm. The VIP hierarchy, where it gets, Miami gets, originally it was like Thursday or Friday morning was the VIP day. It just keeps getting moved up. I was told recently, so now it's like Tuesday is the first VIP day, and then all the way down to like the weekend, when it's just the bridge and tunnel, or the commoners, they get in. So and here's where I wanted to draw that comparison when I mentioned the preaching the converted. These people who participate in art fairs are the least likely to be self-cognizant of these types of, except for the fact that, if they're like somewhere in the middle of the pack, they're very conscious of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately the VVVVVIPs are can afford not to be conscious of it, and they don't really care. They're just there to buy nice things and hang out and do whatever they're going to do with all their money. I think if you walk around an art fair and you talk to the people at the stalls and the gallerists and many of the other functionaries, all of us who are sort of the scribes of the powerful, essentially, which is what we are if we're hanging out at an art fair and not a millionaire or billionaire.
Yeah.
I think everyone there at that level is usually quite well educated and usually often quite critical. I mean, my experience of doing some research at art fairs during this during this talk is one of this, like, as I was speaking about before, this incredible sort of cognitive dissonance where on the one hand you can be talking, about Frantz Fanon and the need to have, kind of a merciless revolution with over one beer, and then the next minute they've turned around and they're talking to someone who, literally a second ago they were talking about wheeling up to the guillotine. I mean, there's a kind of level of cognitive dissonance here that I think means that even though Gao in this piece is speaking to practitioners of a kind of sort of radical form of art, I think that there's a kind of interplay between these people in different ways. I mean, I'll just give you an example. If we were to go to an art fair and ask a lot of the people who are the art handlers or the people who are doing front of house sales or working for commercial galleries or working in many of the sort of administrative roles in that space, many of those people are in fact critical artists who are just doing that as a day job. That's still part of the art economy. And those are the people that I think would likely be interested in reading a book like mine, or would attend a conference such as the one that Gao did his performance at.
Right.
So it's the way that it all comes around. And I think this is, in that passage We mentioned the work of Andrea Fraser. This is sort of part of her point in this quite nice essay called L'un passant, c'est moi, the 1%, it's me, where she points out that even those who are on the radical fringes of the art world are still, by this kind of strange gravitational pull, embroiled in the economy that makes it all
Right. Yeah, that sounds like a great article to check out. And thank you for enlightening me as to Gao's pronunciation. Apologies for the guff.
Yeah, it's a Canadianized.
Oh, I see. Got it. Right, right. Yeah, so tell me a little bit more. I'm really curious that you, as part of your research, you did, how many art fairs did you go to?
I think two.
Which
ones?
Which ones?
I was at Art Stage in Singapore, which I was invited to as a guest speaker, which was a very, very strange experience. And in fact, it was in Singapore that I got to go to the art storage facility.
Right.
And I was at one several years ago at the beginning of this research in New York, and honestly, I can't remember which one it was.
Was it in the spring?
It was a long time.
Was it around the Armory Art Fair?
I think it must have been the Armory. Yeah.
And so, you know, regardless of your specific recollections related to what fair, you know, or what art you saw, what were your overall takeaways, you know, being a observer, an art fair goer?
I mean, I think I was struck, again, as I mentioned earlier, by the level of, I wouldn't even call it cognitive dissonance, because I think that does a disservice to the people, but the level of kind of, let's say, code switching or multiple mental tracks that many of the people who were working at the fair were on. So, I mean, many people had strong educations in critical art theory, critical theory, and were interested in having a quite candid conversation with me about class, about race, about all of the kind of systemic and structural dimensions of the art market that I was interested in. And many of them were very sympathetic to the approach that I was taking at the time that developed into this book. And, you know, as I mentioned, you know, moments later would kind of switch into another code entirely, which was kind of about hyping up the work,
right,
translating or transmuting the critical theory or critical discourse into that kind of substance of contemporaneity that gave the work its value when, you know, they turn around and speak to a collector. And,
right,
you know,
right.
You know. So I was very struck by that. I was struck by how incredibly boring it was. I mean, really, really profoundly boring. I was struck by, I mean, and again, perhaps as a kind of sociologist, I was mostly interested in the institution itself. So I found it fascinating how the staff had created this multi-layered experience that ultimately, I think, like so many things in our world right now, has multiple worlds coexisting in exactly the same space and time that quite literally unsee each other. So, you know, you'd have people who are at the art fair who are, you know, students at the local art college, and they'd be like wandering around looking at art, and right beside them there'd be someone whose net worth was more than, you know, five independent countries, you know, browsing the same art. And there was a completely different architecture around those people, even though they were in exactly the same space. Because, you know, the elite art collector has gotten invited to the VIP lounge or whatever, the early viewing, and they're back to take another look at something. The way that the acumen and sensitivity by which the gallery assistants could ascertain who someone was through a series of questions at the booth to figure out if this person was actually worth talking to or not. You know, and I can reveal that, of course, as a researcher, I am definitely not worth talking to at the art fair itself if there's a billionaire around there.
Right.
But I, you know, I was very innocent, so I would just be like, oh, I'm a researcher. You know, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
You know, that researcher means no money.
Yeah. What do you think you were perceived as before, or who, I should say, were you perceived as before it was revealed, do you think, generally?
Well, the kind of most intensive experience I had was at the Art Stage Art Fair in Singapore, which is largely targeted, not exclusively, but largely targeted towards Asian markets. So I think as a kind of bearded, long-haired, white person, I was quite quickly pigeonholed correctly as either a critic, an artist, or, you know, like someone like I was not there with a lot of money to buy something.
Yeah.
If someone who looked like me had a bunch of money, I probably wouldn't be going to Singapore to buy art. I'd probably be going to Miami or Los Angeles or New York or London or Frankfurt or Basel. So I think quite quickly people ascertained that I was, I don't dress particularly well. So I think that they pretty much marked me from the moment I set foot there.
I'm gonna push back just a tiny bit and say that's all relative, that you're self-deprecating in terms of dressing well. Like, in other words, you're not dressing to the nines as, you know, the collectors are, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I mean, there are collectors who show up in Hawaiian shirts and shorts, but they have a Rolex on, and you know, you can just, there's a certain way that people signify wealth that, or choose to very specifically signify wealth without any signification, that I think was quite revealing at that moment.
Yeah, clearly the Hawaiian shirt and shorts is like, I'm so, you know, wealthy, I don't care kind of approach.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And to go back to your comment about being profoundly bored, to what extent was that the, you know, repetitiveness of the environment and the sort of sealed, you know, oppression of the booths and whatnot, and to what extent was that this art was so, you know, market-driven or based that, you know, it was the kind of thing that just rubs you the wrong way right away? Was it a combination of all that?
Yeah, it was definitely a combination of all that. I mean, what was interesting, I think, about the architecture of the fair was that you had all of these commercial galleries with their booths, and they've selected to exhibit in those booths some of the more provocative work that they have, or some of the more eye-catching work, you know, especially at the front of the booth, where it's going to be able to draw people in. But that work in and of itself is boring precisely because its provocative or eye-catching aspects are so ultimately banal. You know, it'll be like, you know, horror movie iconography, or some like big kind of oversized canvas that's, you know, looks like a nebula of stars or something. I mean, the way in which these galleries signified artistic charisma, even though it was attempting to be entertaining and captivating and sets their booth apart from others, was ultimately, I think, extremely boring.
Right. Yeah, I think you're very perceptive in a way that somebody who's new to art fairs, you know, you wouldn't expect, because I think people who have done a few art fairs sort of recognize the types, you know, the categories of galleries and their display philosophies, you know, and I think you just kind of summarized, you know, some of those categories.
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's just so much value in coming to a field completely new and trying to make sense of it from, you know, as if you're an alien from outer space, which is certainly how I felt.
Right. Did you feel, I mean, to what extent are you, you know, a sensitive person in terms of social scenes and settings?
I would say very.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's not what I would have expected. Well, welcome to the club. Sorry as well. All right. So the next section, zero participation, benign pessimism, tactical parasitics, and the encrypted common, starting at page 112. So I wanted to get, before we end this session today, to the Abby Hoffman piece, which, again, I was not familiar with, surprisingly, and listeners probably are not going to be, I'm going to assume as well. Let us begin with an early work of participatory money art, the infamous action by Abby Hoffman and the Yippies, the Youth International Party. On August 24th, 1967, the ragtag crew dressed in business suits or other outlandish costumes and ascended to the observation deck of the New York Stock Exchange trading floor, abuzz with the frenetic rituals of open call trading, and threw thousands of dollars worth of $1 bills down on the traders below. According to Hoffman's recollections, at least, this action, posed at the intersection of art and activism, threw the already frenzied atmosphere into utter chaos, with traders scrambling to collect this manna from heaven. We will analyze the Yippie stunt in more detail below as both an intervention into and an example of what Lauren Berlant calls cruel optimism. For now, it is simply worth observing how much has changed since 1967. Today, such an action would be imprecise at best, anachronistic at worst. In 1983, the NYSE replaced the charismatic scene of open call trading with computerized exchanges. Most traders today work from nearby or increasingly distant or even offshore offices. Meanwhile, the trading of the vanilla corporate stocks listed on the NYSE has been replaced with the trading of much more complex financial products and derivatives, which, while they may ultimately be based on basic financial assets like shares in corporations, government bonds, or raw material commodities, are more accurately described as synthetic assets made up of thousands of different assets, or derivatives designed to, with surgical precision, manage risk. Further to the point, the novelty of handing out money no longer so captures the imagination in an age when a $1 bill buys practically nothing of value in New York City, and when, in any case, a huge percentage of the population, especially those who work on Wall Street, perform most of their transactions through digital payment mechanisms. At stake in these questions is the possibility for a critical money art in an age of digitized money, where money is in some senses everywhere and nowhere at once. In contrast to the 1960s, when it seemed possible to make a critical intervention in the fraught space between money and social life, today all of society is encrypted by money, which is to say that, as we have seen, there is practically no domain where money does not seek to recode social life. Among the effects of this shift and acceleration has been the sequestering of financial flows in ever fewer hands. The power to create and use such technologies is far out of the reach of not only most people, but also most financial corporations. Amidst the AI arms race, that is to say artificial intelligence arms race, between a handful of key players, it is simply impossible for any actor without tens of hundreds of millions of dollars to do much more than bet on the residual or derivative currents kicked up by the Leviathans. Meanwhile, would-be regulators must contend with not only the infamous hyper-complexity of financial markets themselves, but now also the speed and sophistication of cutting-edge digital technologies. In essence, the digitized financialization of money has encrypted society in a matrix of speculative gambles, methodologies of risk management, and metrics of evaluation. The risk here is less of Big Brother in any classically dystopian sense, but rather of the increasing recalibration of nearly every aspect of life to ensure its participation in a massive chaos machine that thrives on uncertainty and volatility, not to mention oppression, exploitation, and inequality. So we're just going to end today with the reproduction in your book, Figure 37, from March 29th, 2014, the activist ensemble Global Ultra Luxury Faction, or GULF, staged an action reminiscent of Abbie Hoffman's 1967 intervention at the New York Stock Exchange, releasing thousands of invented banknotes into the Guggenheim Museum's iconic spiral rotunda during the busy Saturday evening when the museum offers free admission to the public. GULF, an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street, seeks to raise awareness and hold blue-chip arts institutions like the Guggenheim to account for abusive labor practices toward migrant workers who are building satellite locations overseas, in this case in Abu Dhabi. One side of the note depicted the, quote, speculative global museum, unquote, represented by the Guggenheim's other iconic building in Bilbao, flanked by images of financial profligacy and oil derricks, which was deemed, quote, of no sustainable cultural value, unquote. The reverse side featured an image of Occupy Wall Street's encampment and Manhattan's Zuccotti Park and begged the question, what would an ethical global museum look like? And proposed, quote, free of labor abuse, free of odious debt, artistic freedom. And then I just wanted to add, in terms of performance or I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name, but there's Improv Everywhere, along the lines of the Improv Everywhere School of Art Making, also in the Guggenheim. There was most recently, people probably heard about, a stage protest in the Rotunda of the Guggenheim that was directed towards the Sacklers, supporters, great beneficiary or benefactors of the Guggenheim, among many other institutions. And this one that was organized by the photographer, I'm blanking on her name, but
Nan Golden.
Thank you very much. Nan Golden was a tossing, correct me if I'm wrong, of prescriptions of oxycodone into the Rotunda. So
yeah.
All that said, maybe we should, you can direct your response to the legacy of the Yippies, you know, Peace on Wall Street, and compared with iterations, you know, not using money, but rather using more symbolic paperwork more recently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I still go back and forth on my interpretation of the Hoffman stunt. On one level, and I think probably we'll talk about this next time we speak, I do frame it in terms of a kind of cruel optimism, that ultimately this was a stunt that was kind of funny and historic in many ways, but it was never going to work in a certain way. You know, it was never going to have this moment where, you know, a traitor stoops to pick up the money and then, you know, has this crisis of conscience and says, oh, my God, what am I doing with my life?
Right.
You know, it was really, I argue in the book, that this was really about reproducing the subjectivity and the community of the Yippies themselves. And I think it's slightly different in the context of the interventions at the Guggenheim recently, though they echo quite self-consciously the Hoffman piece. Because I think in those two cases, both Gulf, the activist group Gulf, and the Sackler Payne activist group, they're engaging in this tactic as part of a broader strategy. You know, they're using this intervention to put pressure on the Guggenheim board in order to divest, in the first case, from their odious labor practices in Abu Dhabi, building a satellite museum. In the second case, to refuse the philanthropy of the Sackler family, which has been responsible for, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of deaths, really, from the opioids overdose. So in the case of the latter two, the more recent ones, there's a sense that this action is a means to an end. Whereas for the Yippies, there was a sense that this was a much broader action that was kind of poking in the eye of capitalism writ large. There was no sense that it played into a larger strategy. It was just part of this kind of tactical irreverency that they developed. And so when I wrote that chapter, I was fairly skeptical towards the Yippies. And I think in the end, maybe it's simply that in the intervening years since I wrote the chapter and the publication of the book and it's, you know, et cetera, et cetera, it hasn't been that long, I've become a little more sympathetic to nonsensical acts that antagonize and take a kind of small revenge upon the powerful. So these days I'm a little more sympathetic to Hoffman than I was when I wrote the chapter.
I see. Well, I wonder, you used the word tactical irreverence, I think it was. But in any case, the sentiment or, you know, perhaps the larger weight of the piece, the Hoffman piece, and the attitude, I think is the word I'm looking for, the larger attitude of a piece like that, as you described it, strikes me as analogous to a lot of art, contemporary art in particular, you know, in contrast to the Gulf piece and the, you know, the protest piece, which are more indeed a means to an end. The former is more, you know, to use a little vernacular language, a form of sort of thoughtful fucking around, really, you know,
and then in
the greater art world, with a market benefit to boot in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Hoffman, the spirit of Hoffman is very much alive in kind of perverted form in a lot of contemporary art, in the sense that, you know, contemporary art now is bombastic, self-aggrandizing, pushes conventions on a very sort of surface level, and it's very much aimed at creating a kind of in-the-know sort of community that collectors and others somehow want to be part of. And I think that's the worst aspect of the Yippies and Hoffman's practice. The best aspect of the Yippies and Hoffman's practice is that they were ardent anti-capitalists for a long time, and that they they had a sense, along with many many activists and art and sort of cultural activists of the late 1960s and early 70s, that the revolution that they wanted wasn't simply going to be a kind of economic overturning at the top of society, but would be a radical transformation of everyday life. And that's the part that I like about what they were doing. You know, they did create a community where people were dedicated and helped each other radically liberate themselves from the norms and conventions of society. And I think there's still a place for that. But I think the worst aspect has really been taken up in contemporary art in a certain way that, you know, is attached to these kind of these spectacles that are sort of like create these kind of big cultural explosions. But at the end of it, you kind of wonder who's actually been damaged.
Yeah.
And, you know, what has actually been achieved.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the legacy of the Hoffman, of the Yippies, to use the larger group, as the collectives, socially engaged collectives or individual artists that maybe are working outside the market system? Groups like Improv Everywhere, maybe more specifically, all of the above. How would you put it?
Well, I think it's gone in a number of different ways. I think there are still many groups who do quite amazing work in this legacy, and I think about people that I know, friends John Jordan and Isabella Frameau, who have an organization where they work with activists, especially climate activists, to develop really provocative artistic interventions at protests. Jordan was involved in Reclaim the Streets. And I think there's a long tradition that kind of now goes under the name of art activism or artivism that uses these kind of tactics in order to serve broader activist strategies. You can think about a group like the Yes Men, for instance, who, you know, have become quite popular, using similar sort of interventions to draw attention or to problematize. So on one hand, I think that's part of the legacy that's been inherited from the Yippies. Unfortunately, I think the other side of the legacy maybe ties into what I was talking about before, but also has to do with the way that many of the themes and even many of the protagonists from the late 1960s and early 1970s radical art and cultural movements actually by the late 70s and early 80s had transitioned into positions of power. So, you know, there's quite a bit of literature about the way that some of the kind of radical countercultural movements of the baby boomer coming of age moment translated themselves into the kind of ethos of Silicon Valley, the kind of libertarian, business-oriented, innovation-driven, let's break all the rules type of quote-unquote innovation or, you know, experimentation that have actually become the kind of norm now and the dominant paradigm in a kind of digitized capitalism. And, you know, even in the 1980s and 90s, especially I think in the 2000s, even financiers themselves started kind of thinking in these terms where they would think about themselves less as kind of like efficient bureaucrats, as they might have in the 1960s and 70s, and began to think about themselves as these kind of cunning and daring entrepreneurs who, like artists, were sort of ready to take psychedelic drugs and think outside the box and, you know, get their hands dirty and make interventions, the birth of the so-called activist shareholder and these kind of personas of the entrepreneur and financier that see them as creating order out of chaos or seizing upon risk and opportunity. So I think in a weird way, the spirit of Hoffman and the Yippies goes in another direction as well.
Mm-hmm.
That has become actually part of the mainstream in the reproduction of an increasingly digitized and financialized capitalism.
Of the legacy or the influence of the Yippies, I want to go back in particular to when you talked about your friends and doing artivism, you know, as it's so called known to me, which is something I've heard, but maybe I'm not, as I would imagine a lot of listeners are not especially familiar with. To me, and you're going to have to clarify this for us, because my instinct is to say, okay, so an artivist is somebody who collaborates with an activist to maybe make an activist action maybe more palatable, more give it an artistic edge, add some flourish to it so that it's not so, you know, depressing and dry. Am I anywhere near the mark in that perception?
No, I think that's true. That's true. And also to do it in a way, I mean, Jordan and Fermeau, who I mentioned, talk about art as sometimes being a kind of shield, that because of the residual prestige and institutional location of this thing we call art, you can sometimes get away with things under its banner that you wouldn't get away with if you, for instance, were just calling it activism. You know,
it's
a kind of Trojan horse, which in ways that I think Haka was experimenting with in the 60s.
Got it. Well, I think we're almost at 2 hours. I really appreciate your your fortitude and patience, and I hope it wasn't incredibly boring hearing me read from your book. But
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure and an honor.
Likewise. And just to give people a little bit of a preview, we're going to get into Cruel Optimism in more detail, and I'm really excited to get into Tactical Parasitics, featuring perhaps my favorite piece from the book. So that's what we have to look forward to. Max, thank you so much again. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. I look forward to next time.
Me too. And for now, we are out. Huge thanks again to Max Haven. The pleasure and the honor is all mine, I could have said when we ended that recording. Indeed, that was the case. Before we jump into the old news for the week, thank you again to all of you who have recently stepped up as a result of my request for support of the show, particularly in light of the value that I think you are getting from this series with Max, and particularly including Norval, who is based in rural Far East Coast Australia and whose Instagram handle for his art is at Norval Watson. And you too can receive a shout out when you donate to the show. Though meanwhile, thanks again to those of you who donated without the shout out. And really appreciate it, all of you guys. By the way, if you do donate to the show, if you donate, let's just say $15 or more, I'll get you the most recent bonus episode with market scholar Natasha Dagan from the prior episode. We had a bonus segment. And if you donate $35 or more to the show, I will get you all eight bonus episodes of the show. And I can probably hook you up with some P-word bumper stickers and or conversation bumper stickers as well. And by the way, the reason that I continue to ask for your support is because we do not have advertising. And the objective, as I mentioned in the last episode, if I can raise approximately $200 from you guys per episode, which is a big ask and going to be very challenging to do, we can kind of call it the equivalent of an advertisement in terms of fundraising. So it really does help the show keep going. So thank you very much for your support in advance. And I hope that you are indeed getting your money's worth if you do donate. All right. Let's see. Before we get to the old news, finally, to end the show, I do want to also put out the word that I am looking for assistance on the podcast, various producer-type roles. It is a volunteer position or situation, if you prefer, but it will expose you to behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. You will get to connect with people in the art world of various types, if that impresses you or is something appealing to you, or otherwise you could be involved on a more silent, you know, not connecting or communicating with people in the art world level. That's certainly an option as well. In any case, get in touch with me if you are interested and I will tell you more. You can just email theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you very much for your interest. All right, finally, let's get to the old news. Thank you, Megan Bickle, for putting these together. It's just a trio, and they go something like this. Ex-Sotheby's chief now works for the Mughrabis. Adam Chin was known as a take-no-prisoners dealmaker. That is from ArtNet. Next comes from ArtNet as well. Surprise, surprise. Do you come from a wealthy family? You're more likely to become an artist. A new study suggests that a major determining factor in whether a person becomes an artist is his or her family's wealth. The paper, titled The Origins of Creativity, The Case of the Arts in the United States Since 1850, was published in February by Carol John Borowiecki, a professor of economics at the University of Southern Denmark. It's based on census data from the United States going back to 1850. Based on the data, Borowiecki also found that beginning in 1890, there was an uptick in the number of women working in creative occupations. That trend has continued through the present day, most predominantly for musicians, followed by authors, visual artists, and actors. In total, women are 18% more likely than men to work in the arts. Quote, these results challenge the conventional wisdom that the arts are predominantly a male domain, unquote. Again, that's ArtNet. And finally, and this time from Art News, Betty Tompkins ousted from Instagram. Artist Betty Tompkins, whose work frequently explores physical intimacy through a feminist lens, has been kicked off Instagram for sharing an image of her Fuck Painting No. 1, 1969, which is in the collection of the Centre Pompidou in Paris. Art News. Well, that's enough Fuck Painting No. 1 we have time for this week. Thank you guys so much for listening, for your support, and do let us know if you have any questions for Max for our next recording coming up soon. Thank you very much, and I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.